Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Molly Taylor-Pileski, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Tara Numedal and Donna Billick about their new book, Furnace and Fugue, a digital edition of Michael Myers' Atalanta Fugens with scholarly commentary. This is a digital publication on a musical alchemical emblem book from 1618, which was sponsored by the Mellon Digital Publications Initiative from Brown University, and recently published by the University of Virginia Press. Dr. Billick is an academic and a goldsmith. She's the creative director of 12 Keys Consultancy and Design, LLC, and an independent scholar studying early modern science. Her research extends to the cross-cultural examination of jewelry, artisanal technologies, and meaning-making with materials. Dr. Numedal is professor of history and Italian studies at Brown University. She's also the author of Alchemy and Authority in the Holy Roman Empire, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2007, Anna Ziegler and the Lion's Blood, Alchemy and End of Times in Reformation Germany from the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2019, and an edited volume, John Abbott and William Swainson, Art, Science, and Commerce in 19th Century Natural History. Donna and Tara, welcome to New Books in History.
Hi, thank you.
Glad to be here.
I was wondering if you could start us off by just telling us about Furnace and Fugue. Where did this idea come from?
Okay. Well, I think I'll dive into this question. This project is actually a project of serendipity. It was never really, you know, it didn't follow like a very formalized start in terms of, oh, here's a project that we're going to do and let's all, you know, assemble all of the pieces and get a nice orderly start. That part happened about 4 years after its inception. The genesis of this project actually is in my 2013 postdoc fellowship that I had at the Science History Institute, which is in Philadelphia. I had gotten a postdoc to basically explore some ideas I had about Michael Myers' Atalanta Fugens, which is this really amazing, lavishly illustrated, enigmatic, beautiful musical alchemical emblem book. It was published in 1618. And I'd been curious about it for quite some time, you know, at that time, I was a graduate student, and I had accidentally stumbled on a reference to Atalanta Fugens while I was supposed to be working on my dissertation, which was a totally different subject. But anyway, I wound up getting a postdoc at Science History Institute back in 2013. And my area of expertise is really allegory and emblematics. So I was taking a really deep dive into the illustrated content of Atalanta Fugens, because when you open up the book, the left-hand side of the page is music scored for three voices, and the right-hand side of the page is a presentation of an emblem, which means that The theme of the emblem is introduced by a motto, so a very short, pithy piece of text at the top of the page. And then there's this enigmatic illustration, and then there's an epigram. So an emblem really has these three components to it: music, image, text. I'm not a musicologist or a performer, and this stuff is scored in, or this, the music is scored in 17th century notation, which is not the same at all as like current day notation. So fully half of the book was behind a massive disciplinary barrier for me. So one of the first things I did as a postdoc, because there were some recordings out there, like there's a MIDI, and you know, there'd been some Plus Ultra, Ensemble Plus Ultra actually put out a really cool CD of all of the fugues. That's what Michael Meyer calls, the author of the book refers to the music as fugues, which is actually a pun on fugere, the Latin verb to flee. Anyway, so Ensemble Plus Ultra has a really great CD, but they also instrumentalized it. There's like a Chinese zither in it, and they really ironed out the music to make it more listenable, because it's frankly weird. But so while that CD is really enjoyable to listen to, you know, when you're cooking pasta or something, or just, you know, wanting to be meditative, but as a scholarly research tool, it just didn't help me out at all. So through connections, actually, within the fellowship program at Science History Institute, I got introduced to Robin Beer, who is the director of a vocal ensemble called Les Canards Chantants. She really opened up the music to me, by bringing in her singers and explaining to me how the music actually complemented the images. And I started working with a classicist by the name of Anthony Parenti, really talented student from Temple University, who showed me just the wonders of grammar in the Latin epigrams. Like, I had no idea that the grammar was so sensitive to encoding the meaning. So between working with Robin and working with Anthony, the Latin and the music became accessible to me, and I began to understand, oh my God, like this is a really complex, you know, work of intellectual engineering going on here. And then I also got this, this is a long story, but I had this understanding that the book itself is encrypted. So I started working with a mathematician named Brian Hadley, and he really helped me to explore my argument that the book is actually designed around a hidden magic square. I can get into that later. So all this is to say that by the time I finished my postdoc, after a year, I was working with about 15 different people in distinct disciplines. I was working with a Hebrew scholar, with mathematicians, with music performers and musicologists. And it occurred to me, oh my God, this is a lot of fun. What if, you know, we held a workshop and brought everyone together? Because, you know, I had been working with everyone independently. Wouldn't it be cool to see what everyone had to say about the book if we were all together in a room? So Ron Brashear, who was then the library director at Science History Institute, funded exactly such a workshop in March 2015. And this is where I brought in the team that I'd been working with, as well as a few other scholars who I really admired and really wanted to get to know, like Tara. And here's where I nerd out a bit, because I was a huge fan of Tara's scholarship, and I'd known Tara as a book on my library shelf, and I was like, and now's my chance to get to meet her. So so Tara was part of this experimental workshop where basically I forbade the formal presentation of papers, and I was just like, we're here to play with the book. Les Canards Chantants was there in full force with six or seven singers. They're to be used as tools. Like, if we wanted to hear a fugue sung backwards, they would do it. You know, if we wanted to, just being able to experiment with the music through live performance. They also got us to sing from the book. It was amazing. Like, that was one of the most magical moments of my life as a scholar, in the Othmar Library at Science History Institute with about, you know, 20 scholars all organized around three or four different copies of Atlantifugians, because other libraries in the area had pulled together and brought together their copies so that we could also, you know, examine the different copies. Anyway, so basically Furnace and Fugue has its genesis in this experimental workshop. Tara came up to me afterwards because we had also discussed, you know, at the end of the workshop, what could this book look like as a digital edition? This was always something I really thought was the way forward in terms of presenting the book. And Brown Library had just received the Mellon Award for the Digital Publications Initiative. And Tara was like, well, do you want to collaborate on a proposal? And I was like, oh my God, this is scary. Like, letting go of the project. So I took a deep, but I also wanted to do it. Because I also knew that this project is just way too big for any one person to try and handle. I mean, Michael Meyer was a polymath. None of us today are. So you really do have to work across the disciplines and draw in people with particular kinds of expertise in order to unpack the riches of this book. So I took a deep breath and said yes. And that was the beginning of like a really awesome, deeply enjoyable and transformative scholarly relationship. So we ended up, to our surprise, getting the award, not getting the award, excuse me, I misspoke. To my surprise, we got we got accepted as a pilot project, the first of two. And so I brought my team of, or the community of scholars that I'd pulled together during my postdoc to Brown to work with Tara on creating Furnace and Fugue. So that's really where Furnace and Fugue formally began to become organized, was at Brown, once we had, once our proposal had gotten approved. So that's my, 11 minute answer to your one second question.
Oh, that was wonderful. I thought you were taking us on this wonderful journey of a research journey, but it was like a dream research journey where you are just interacting with people and traveling and unlocking secrets.
Yeah. And it was mostly by those first couple of years, it was a lot of serendipity, I gotta say. And the formalization came after a really fun, fruitful period of just exploration and experimentation.
Maybe I can pick up the story a little bit from there, because I think it was sort of at that moment when we decided to, you know, formalize this a little bit, right, and put in this application to the Brown Digital Publishing Initiative. So Brown, my institution, had just gotten this Mellon grant to, you know, rethink the scholarly monograph in the digital age, right? And we just, at the end of Donna's workshop at the Science History Institute, everybody thought this has to be digital, you know, this has to be the way to do it. And it just seemed like a perfect project for this. And, you know, I had not done digital scholarship before. So, but this book just lent itself to digital publication in a way that other things I had worked on hadn't. So it just seemed to really fit. So we put in this proposal, and then we decided we needed to kind of take another pass at the style of workshop that Donna had done at the Science History Institute, but do it again, really with a more focus on what would this look like as a digital publication. And so in the winter of 2016, we brought, again, a really interdisciplinary and international group of scholars to Brown. Les Canards Chantants came again and performed some of the music. And a really beautiful, it was one of those wintry days where we thought, you know, no one was going to make it because there was a snowstorm in Providence, and the skies cleared just in time. And it was this beautiful sort of snowy afternoon. And we had this great performance lecture about the book. And then we spent the weekend with about, I think, 40 scholars, maybe, right, Donna? you know, just again, kind of playing around with possibilities of how could we do this digitally. And so it was really those two very loose workshops that gave us all these different ideas for how to do it. And then once our proposal was accepted into the Digital Publishing Initiative, we really plugged into this team of people at Brown who could support actually making this project mm-hmm. real, right? And the goal of that was always to produce a peer-reviewed scholarly monograph, but an innovative one, something, you know, that would sort of work within the usual evaluation context of universities where people do need to get tenure and, you know, promotion and so on, but that was also digital. And part of the goal there from Brown's perspective was to produce models of digital scholarship that that other people can point to if they want to do this kind of work and also get tenure, right? So it was important to us to publish with the university press and go through the peer review process, even as it was also so important to us to do something really creative and different, right? And from the very beginning, digital. And so we really benefited from the resources at Brown to allow us to realize that. And then eventually University of Virginia Press. So, I mean, it really is this sort of story of harnessing all of this creativity, but then really benefiting from, you know, funding and institutions in the end to make it happen, right?
That's a wonderful collaborative project. And I'd like to turn and sort of describe for the listeners what this is like, because I'm a digital historian, and so I've sort of seen the last 20 years of digital history develop, and this is such a beautiful addition that, just as you said, Tara and Donna, really takes advantage of the dynamic things that you can do online that you can't necessarily do in print. I was wondering if you could describe a little bit about how you set up the book and then what the argument of the book is, both maybe you could describe a little bit more about the structure of the original source from 1618, and then how you were able to play with that in the digital medium.
Okay, shall I take this one, Donna?
You jump in and then I'll follow up. Yeah.
Okay. So as Donna has already kind of explained, this is an emblem book. And this is an emblem book written by a German physician and alchemist, Michael Meyer, which purports to be a kind of alchemical interpretation of Ovid's myth of Atalanta. And so you think from the title page that this is going to be about the myth of Atalanta, who was a very fast runner, whose father wanted her to get married, and she agreed to only marry someone who could beat her in a race. When you open the book and you read further, the author Michael Meyer explains that actually he's going to interpret this alchemically, so that Atalanta represents Mercury, one of the two principles of metals in alchemical theory, and her suitor, Hippomenes, represents sulfur. And so their race is sort of about, and their eventual union is about the union of these two elements in the service of producing the philosopher's stone. The way he beats her in the race is that he gets help from some goddesses who give him golden apples that he drops in front of her during the race. She stops to pick them up and slows down, right? And then he's able to run past her. And so as Donna described, these emblems, once you get into the book, you have on the left-hand side these fugues for three voices. And the voices are Atalanta, Hippomenes, her suitor, and the golden apple. And so these three voices seem to be the race. They're fugues, or we might think of them as canons, like row, row, row your boat, right? Where one voice begins and the next voice follows. And so you sort of, it feels like maybe the sound of the music will be about Atalanta and Hippomenes and this race. If you start paying attention, though, you realize that the words they're singing actually come from the Latin epigrams that are on the other side of the page, which are all about alchemical theory and natural history and medicine and mathematics and, you know, this whole scholarly world. So it's a bit of a bait and switch in a way, because it turns out to be a kind of portal into this entire alchemical corpus and the ways in which it intersects with other scholarly traditions in the early modern period. So this is why, you know, as Donna said, Meyer was a polymath. He can go from astronomy to natural history of salamanders to how to make the philosopher's stone in one emblem. And that's, and then the music can also represent that. And of course, there are images as well. So one also needs to be, you know, an art historian and familiar with visual conventions and bookmaking. And so it's a book that you can very easily appreciate as a beautiful object, but, you know, find completely baffling. And we have a copy at Brown University. I've taken my students to see it for years, and they always looked at it and said, wow, that's amazing. I have no idea what's going on in this book, right? It's gorgeous. I don't understand it. So, and I think Donna and I both in our experience with this book felt the same way, that, you know, there was so much in this that we didn't understand. And so we really began from this place of this has to be a multidisciplinary collaboration, right? And Donna set up this original workshop in her own research to follow that. That is not something, you know, we are impoverished as modern scholars in a way because of modern disciplinary specialization. So I might understand the alchemical part, but I don't understand the music at all, right? And people who had written about the music understand what's going on there, but maybe don't understand the images. And so we had to talk to each other. And so the result is that we have a digital book that has several parts to it that are designed to make the book accessible to multiple different audiences, and also to allow audiences to go a little bit deeper if they really want to get into the scholarship. So I'll just briefly kind of describe the parts of the book, and then maybe say something about the argument, and then maybe Donna wants to jump in and expand on some things. It's both a edition of Atalanta Fugien's, Meyer's 1618 text, which we incorporated a contemporary 17th century translation into English. So although the original book is in Latin and German and music and image, you can read it in English, in 17th century English. You can switch back and forth between languages. So you can sort of, you can see it in the original if you want to, or you can read it in English. And you can navigate through the book in ways that maybe we can talk a little bit about later. But in addition to the edition of the book itself, we've included three very short introductory essays that are designed to orient users who don't know anything about the early modern period, or who maybe know about part of it, but not other parts. So those three introductory essays are very short. They are on the history of alchemy by Jennifer Rampling. They are on Michael Meyer and Who He Is by Harold Tilton. And they're about the print history of the book from Steve Tabor at the Huntington Library. So those are designed to kind of outline Meyer's world a little bit and allow readers to find their footing. And then we've included a set of essays by scholars, musicologists, art historians, historians of alchemy, and so on, that, you know, are much more like conventional scholarly articles, except that they're digital. So, you know, you can go in. So Donna's idea about the magic square is the subject of her article. And so that's for people who really want to get into the scholarship and understand our scholarly intervention into the history of alchemy, the history around this book in particular, but also really scholarly culture more generally in the early modern period. And I would just very briefly describe that intervention as saying that, first of all, you know, what's different about our study of Atalanta Fugien's from previous studies is this multidisciplinary collaboration at the heart of it. Second of all, we're writing about Atalanta Fugien's in light of this real transformation in the history of alchemy in the last few decades, that scholars now understand alchemy no longer, you know, as sort of only philosophy, you know, or something that is linked tightly to Hermeticism and Rosicrucianism and philosophy. It is all of those things, but scholars in the last few decades have really explored alchemy's connections also to the material world and understood it as a material practice and through its links to early modern science and medicine. So we're sort of informed by this new scholarly consensus in the history of alchemy, and we're trying to reposition Atalanta Fugien's as not only a literary text, a clever kind of pun on Ovid's Tale of Atalanta, you know, even better adorned with music, but also as an invocation of and really meditation on actual laboratory technologies for how to make the philosopher's stone. And so that's the largest context for this, is that we see this book, and particularly the scholarly essays, as a commentary on shifting anxieties in the early modern period around disciplines that really bridged sense and intellect and theory and practice and scholarship and craft. Disciplines, early modern disciplines like music, right, like alchemy, like medicine, and like art, all of which had theoretical traditions but also material practices. And our kind of the biggest argument, I think, of Furnace and Fugue is that we need to understand Meyer's book, Atalanta Fukien's, as an intervention into those debates that were happening in the early 17th century. So that's sort of an overview of the book, both what it looks like and the scholarly intentions behind it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is a really wonderful scholarly edition, as you mentioned, Tara, but it's also, I think, because of its beautiful design and interactivity, something that will attract a popular audience. And I'm wondering, how do you imagine that both the lay reader and the specialized reader will approach this book, and what kinds of meanings will they take out of it? Since I imagine it will be a highly individualized experience for each reader.
Yes, thank you for that. And that was, you know, I should say that the accessibility was really part of this from the very beginning. So for example, I mentioned the translation so that you don't have to be an expert in Latin to read Meyer's book. We also created new recordings of all of the fugues for three voices, so that even if you can't read the music, you can still hear the music. They're also recorded as separate tracks so that you could only focus in on one voice if you wanted to, or perhaps two voices. Again, we've included these brief introductory essays to orient people. So I think when we created this, we wanted to speak to our colleagues in the field, you know, historians of this world, but we definitely wanted to bring in new kind of audiences as well. And I will say that one of the things about the history of alchemy is that it hasn't ended. There are still, you know, there are lively communities of alchemical practitioners in the world, and they are very often very interested in this book because it's such a beautiful and enigmatic and engaging book. And we really wanted to make our work accessible to them as well. Early music performers often know of Atalanta Fukien's because of the music that's included in Meyer's book, and we wanted to bring them into the conversation. We've included a performance edition as well, and so we really welcome, you know, additional performances of the music in Meyer's book. And of course, you know, because I teach it at a university, I imagine my students, and I've already had some of my students begin to work with the edition to write papers. And so on that point, I just wanted to mention one other feature of Furnace and Fugue that for us was one of the things you could do digitally that you can't really do as easily with a paper book, and that is the collections feature. So any particular user, of course, you can read the different essays, you can look at the original edition, but built into it and accessible from different points in Furnace and Fugue is the collections feature. So if you, for example, were a student and you decided you wanted to write a paper about representations of women in Atalanta Fukien's, you can go into the image search and search for images of women, or you could do a text search and find, you know, textual references to women. And you could create a collection of all of the emblems that have images of women, or birds, or, you know, cubes, or dragons, or mythological creatures, or early modern figures, and or fire, or laboratory tools, right? And so you can build your own collection of emblems and essentially pull them out of their original order in Atalanta Fukien's, which is 1 through 50 emblems, right? But you could look at the connections between emblem 11 and emblem 23 if you wanted to, or create a collection of, you know, 4 or 5 emblems and look at them together. And so we are really hoping that
scholars, students, musicians, alchemists, just general, you know, people who like early modern books, will find that to be a way to engage with Meyer's book in a way that is, as you say, really individualized, really creative, and allow them to, you know, read the scholarly arguments, but then maybe try them out for themselves, right? And create their own arguments from what we've given them there.
Yeah, like in terms of reimagining the book in the 21st century, we kind of took the motto from Emblem 11, I think it is, literally, which translates roughly, tear the book apart.
That's what it sounds like when you're describing that. It sounds like tearing the book apart. But another thing that I liked about this is that you don't lose the materiality of the original source either, because you have this great video of somebody turning the pages of the book. This is what it all looks like together. But then you can absolutely make it your own, which is just so interesting.
Spoiler alert and full disclosure, that's Tara turning the pages.
Oh, I was wondering. Yeah, lovely manicured hands.
I think we had to retake that one because Tara was wearing like a really ungainly watch or something in the first one and was just like, no, we're not using that.
This is so interesting, Donna, because my next question was, what were some of the interesting things that you learned in the process of co-writing or co-editing this book? And I didn't imagine that would be the answer, but I'll let you answer seriously as well.
Yeah, actually, before we move to that question, there just was a couple of things I wanted to add to Tara's like amazing, elegant, thorough description of, you know, what the book does digitally. In terms of why we reimagine the book as something that the reader himself or herself or their self could reshuffle. And this relates really to my idea that that Meyer designed the book around a hidden math puzzle that's known as a magic square. And I'm not going to, you know, get into detailed exposition of my own analysis of that. But basically, when you collect clues that Meyer has hidden in the music, image, and text, you discover keys to unlock the book as this hidden math puzzle, this magic square. And that completely reshuffles the sequence, which in the book, when you turn the pages, comes across as 1 to 50. But scholars have noted that it's not a sequential storyline. The storyline is all broken up. So when you actually explore the book as a magic square in this like reshuffled configuration, whole new kinds of pairings and it prompts whole new sorts of investigations into the secrets of nature. So in working really closely with the digital scholars and web designers at Brown University, that really informed the design of the digital edition itself, the fact that the user can go in and completely reshuffle the book according to, you know, following your own curiosity or the own prompts or clues that you might discern in Meyer's music, image, or text. And interestingly, a few people in my own network who aren't scholars have reached out to me after playing with the book, saying to just basically give their feedback about experiencing the book. And that element, the collections element, paired up with being able to explore the music either as the downloadable performance edition in the modernized score, or to explore the music by listening to the recordings. And we also visualized the music as a piano roll. There is a piano roll button that you can click in order to follow the musical structure as it plays out. Some of the feedback I've gotten was frankly quite astounding of people trying to sing the book. So people exploring the images and also taking deeper dives into the essays and then going to the music, which hitherto would have been inaccessible, to try and play out their ideas through using their own voice, which I think is absolutely amazing. It's an amazing follow through of Meyer's injunction to the reader, which is on the title page, which is to engage the faculties, the senses of sight, sound, and intellect in investigating the secrets of nature. So in many ways, we echo what Myers, injunction to the reader seems to be through through the text and the title page. So anyway, that was my addendum to Tara's explanation of how the book can work and how we would love people just to play with it and try and break it, I would say, you know, push the boundaries, see what you can get it to do that maybe we didn't even envision. That would be cool to know.
And we see that really, this is Tara, we see that as following Myers' vision. We you know, that one of the arguments of our essays, the collection of essays, is that that is something that Meyer intended. He didn't intend people to read the book cover to cover. It makes no sense that way anyway. And so we see ourselves as kind of facilitating Myers' vision and really following centuries now of readers and users who have, you know, rewritten it, translated it, taken it apart, taken out the music and republished it and so on over the years. So we see this as, you know, a part of a very long tradition of people reading and using, and really that idea of playfulness is core to our project.
Yeah, and digital is uniquely suited as a tool and a medium to do this.
I think that's a wonderful point that we've gotten to, where 400 years after the book was originally published, you can return to some of the original intentions of the author simply because it's not such a staid medium that you have to do it in a linear fashion or in any kind of fashion. And so I think this is just such an exciting parallel that the digital revolution can match up in some ways with the print and knowledge revolution that study.
It's almost 402 years to the date in terms of Myers' publication. I think he published it in August of 1618. If I'm correct, Tara, do you recall?
I don't recall.
Hang on, I'm gonna pull out my facsimile. But it's literally almost four centuries and 2 years to the date. Hang on, hold that thought. I'm grabbing my copy.
Another piece of it, actually, that I'll mention is that when it was the 400th anniversary that year, we did an Instagram project as part of this as well, which still lives at Furnace and Fugue on Instagram, where each week we published on Instagram one of the emblems, and we invited all different kinds of people to comment on the emblem briefly, just in a few sentences. We had neuroscientists, we had a child or two, I think, we had, you know, artists and musicians and all sorts of people. So that was also a really fun way to play around with digital and also to appeal to a much broader audience. And we found, you know, there were Jungian analysts who were following us, and architects and graphic designers, and of course, alchemists and historians and musicians as well. So that was another fun part of this.
Oh, well, why would we stick to one discipline now? I was wondering if there's advice that you would offer to people who are starting digital editions, because this is kind of a new genre. I can think of a couple that do this very well, that they take advantage of the digital platform rather than just try and fit a printed monograph online. Could you offer some advice to people thinking about that in the future?
I think, I mean, you've already just mentioned the key thing, which is to, I think sometimes just because we can, we want to do it, right? And so to stop and think about what is it that digital tools allow me to do with this edition that I can't do with paper. There needs to be a reason to do it, I think. And for us, it was about the sound, it was about hearing, and it was about this ability to reshuffle the emblems, right? So that's one piece of it, is to really think carefully about what it is that you're trying to do digitally that you can't do otherwise. The other thing I'll say is it is expensive. It is, you know, it requires, we were extremely fortunate with the support from Brown and the Digital Publishing Initiative that Donna and I did not have to become experts in TEI, you know, or graphic design, you know, that we were really the beneficiaries of this Mellon funded initiative that allowed us to work with all these experts. And I will say also, if you're able to do that, to kind of open yourself up to the expertise of these graphic designers and programmers and all these other people, because You know, Donna and I alone never, ever would have come up with Furnace and Fugue. It, you know, it was such, and, you know, even the scholars that we worked with and Donna and I never would have come up with Furnace and Fugue. It was so, it's so hinged on the collaborations with the, all of these technologists and book people and TEI people and so on. And so, but, you know, you have to be open to how a programmer might see your project or how a graphic designer might see your project. So for me, that's that was really, one of the revelations and pleasures of this and joys of seeing it come together.
Yeah. Like, one thing I would say, be prepared to have your own vision or expectations recalibrated by what actually makes sense to do digitally. So, you know, ways in which, you know, I would visualize or present my argument, for example, in a PowerPoint, does not necessarily, is not what translated into the digital edition. Like, there's just ways that talking with people who have the expertise in coding, in ways that they can weigh in on and make your argument legible digitally is a really important conversation to have, you know, and just being prepared to let go of, you know, your own ideas in order to let the ideas and expertise of other people who work in this profession to influence what is ultimately produced.
And that's so, as much a commentary on the process of collaboration as it is a, you know, commentary on digital, right? That we really had to kind of surrender to this group project, I think. Yeah. And, you know, I think it worked well for us. It's not always easy. We were on different timelines. And I think it's important to point out time zones. Yeah. It's important to point out too, that Donna and I are approaching this project from really different kinds of positions in the profession, right? I have a full professor at Brown. I was tenured when I started the project, and Donna's an independent scholar. And so we have different kinds of pressures and resources and reasons for doing this project. And for us, that was always really a positive, and I think has produced a better project to collaborate across those kinds of institutional barriers. But it also means that, you know, people have different kinds of priorities and you have to navigate all of that. And yeah, so that was as much about collaboration as the digital.
Yeah.
Well, Donna,
I want to say on that point, or one of the points that Tara just raised, Atalantifugians, the Furnace and Fugue project, is actually what made me decide to become an independent scholar.
Well, explain that now.
Yeah. Well, it's a choice that I embraced happily and joyfully, but also it took me years to realize this was the direction I was headed in. I mean, when I graduated, my dissertation is on a 17th century Puritan alchemist who operated in England and America named John Allen. And when I graduated, well, after I defended, I put out two types of applications, one which was to do what I was supposed to do, which is transform the dissertation into a monograph about John Allen and make a scholarly contribution that way, and also make myself marketable on the tenure track. And so I put out that set of fellowship applications. And I also, by that time, had questions about Atalantifugians, was super intrigued and wanted to have support to take a deeper dive into that research project. That was like my shadow dissertation project that emerged, you know, a couple of years into the dissertation writing. So that turned out to be the fellowship that got funded. Like, so it wasn't like I was trying to be a maverick or buck the system. It was like, you know, I had to follow the funding. So, you know, once the project got started, I just felt I had to commit to seeing it through come what may. And partially through, because I'm Canadian, I decided to apply for a green card. And the pressures that attended that made me really at one point take stock and inventory about what I was doing professionally. What is my professional identity? Am I going on the tenure track or not? And frankly, Atalantifugians or Furnace and Fugue for me represents a project that is not my dissertation, that is a digital edition, so not even a monograph. in a publication medium that there's still no infrastructure in place really to evaluate in certain areas of the tenure track. So it's a digital edition of a research project that isn't my dissertation, that on top of it is a multidisciplinary collaboration, you know? So I realized that I was actually aggressively pursuing fellowships to, you know, support myself in working on Furnace and Fugue and also developing other projects. And I was not aggressively pursuing tenure track positions. So that actually made me pull myself up short and realize, oh, okay, I see what's going on here. So actually, this is what I want to do, pursuing these types of projects that maybe don't easily fit into tenure track requirements. And that's when I decided, no, I am just going to call a spade. I'm stepping out as an independent scholar. And I formally did that in 2018. So Furnace and Fugue was like a transformative experience for me professionally. We talk about alchemical transmutation. I think that's an important part of the story to tell, is that Furnace and Fugue really represents what an independent scholar, myself, and a tenured professor, Tara, can produce in collaboration, in combining our ideas, our access to communities, to resources, with the support of institutions like Brown University Library in this case, and the Mellon Grant, the Digital Publications Initiative. I mean, this is working across the academy. Like, when we work together, this is what we can achieve. It's pretty, pretty beautiful, actually.
And I just wanted to add that I think such an important part of this for us was creating different kinds of models. I think it's very difficult for all of us to think outside of the box, whether it's, you know, the usual kind of career paths. I know the AHA has been doing a lot of work around that and thinking more broadly about what careers as historians look like, or, you know, its career paths or what a book looks like. And I think that there's a lot of desire to think outside of those boxes, but it's not always clear how to do it. And so for us, I think what Furnace and Fugue offers is one model. It's not the only model. It's not doable for everyone, but it offers one model. I mean, along the way, when I would tell some of my colleagues, or, you know, I'm sure Donna had the same experience, what we were doing, nobody could envision what I was talking about. And they would say, oh, how's your website going? Or, you know, I published a digital thing once, and they were talking about a Kindle version of their book. And as much as I tried to articulate that we were trying to do something different, it was really hard for people to get their heads around it until they saw it. And so many of my colleagues then said, oh, now I see what you were doing this whole time. And I think that's true for careers as well, is that we can say to, say, graduate students, you know, keep your minds open for different kinds of career paths, but it helps to see models of people who have navigated that successfully. And so, you know, that's one of my hopes for this project, is that it can offer a model, and I hope that there are many more of them as well, to people who want to think in different ways about what a career as a historian and what scholarship can look like.
Yeah, it's using your independence as an independent scholar. I mean, for several years, my colleagues were asking me, what are you doing, Donna? You should be working on your monograph, you know, your John Allen monograph. And I'm like, in for a penny, in for a pound. I mean, for me, what Furnace and Fugue ended up representing was my commitment to doing what, in the end, I believed was the right thing to do for me, as opposed to the expected thing to do for me. And I would hope that Furnace and Fugue can help to maybe decenter all of the emphasis that is placed on the monograph, because by now it should be abundantly clear that even if I'd wanted to write a monograph about Atalanta Fugians, it's kind of hard to do that in the conventional ways available to us. It kind of has to be a collaborative digital edition in order to be able to dissolve the disciplinary boundaries that up to this point have really siloed scholarship around Atalanta Fugians. There's excellent scholarship on Atalanta Fugians, but our work is the first to really make it accessible across the disciplines For me as a historian of early modern science, to be able to engage with the music as a resource, as a tool of analysis and interpretation. For a musicologist to now be able to engage deeply with the images or the Latin text, if Latin is not available as a part of your methodological toolkit. So for me, investing in Atlantophobians for me is an investment in my cohort and other cohorts going forward, and having academe find ways to understand how to make a project like this count towards either tenure track hires or evaluation or even promotion.
I think that's wonderful. It resonates with me as a professor of digital history. What I tell my graduate students, digital history is experimental and collaborative. And you never want to just be using a tool because it exists. You are primarily dealing with the scholarship of it. So the digital is kind of a means to an end. It's not the ends in itself. And then I just last week told my senior undergraduate history students, who many of them want to go to graduate school, and they say, become a history professor. And I say, when you're in graduate school, make sure that you're following your curiosity. You're not trying to fit the mold, because that's where success in any form is going to come from. It's what you bring to it, not what you think you're supposed to be doing. And so we have benefited, I would say, not just the scholarly early modern European world, but the general public with this edition, which I should also mention is free. And Tara, you said this is a very expensive volume to produce, which I fully recognize. And it is such a gift to us all that we can freely use it at any time. So thank you very much for making this accessible for our students and for any of us who don't have the means to always pay, you know, $180 for a scholarly monograph that only a handful of people can access.
No, I mean, obviously we could not foresee what 2020 was going to look like when we published this book, but I think we feel that it's just all the more important right now when we're all trying to teach online and digitally, and, you know, to make sources like this available to students and faculty to work with. And we were really, really pleased that University of Virginia Press was open to that. And again, that we had the support of Brown in doing that. And it's, you know, really a wonderful aspect of it for us.
Okay, well, we've taken up a lot of your time with this absolutely engaging conversation. Thank you so much. But I'd like to know now, what are you working on?
I think we were joking before we started this podcast about how could we top this? Yeah. Maybe I'll just retire. I'll actually jump in because I do have my next academic project ramping up that I'm super, super, super excited about. I learned so much from Furnace and Fugue about collaboration, about how to use my independence as an independent scholar to really, you know, pull together, design, and execute, you know, the type of research projects that really, you know, float my boat. So Bruce Morin, who's the general editor of Ambix, which is our journal for the history of chemistry and alchemy, he invited me to be a guest editor for a special issue. It's going to be published in February 2023. And I've decided that the subject is on gold and mercury, which I have an interest in, not only as a historian of early modern science, because gold making is part of the alchemical goals in this period in terms of creating chemical medicines. So I don't just have an intellectual interest in gold and mercury, but I also have interest in it as a goldsmith. I want to use mercury-free golds in the pieces that I produce. But in trying to get this material, it's actually really, really hard. And probing why very quickly reveals a Gordian knot of controversy. So I designed a research project that pulls on my network of scholars that includes archaeometallurgists, environmental historians, philologists, scholars working in material culture, to examine these two interrelated metals, gold and mercury, from a transcultural, transhistorical perspective, to understand how these two metals have worked their way through environment, culture, and the body, and the impact that it actually, you know, has upon us. So for me, what's really important also is to really foreground the academic diversity that goes into this project, because this mentorship is an important aspect of this. Collaboration is an important aspect of the Gold and Mercury Project. And it'll feature scholarship from doctoral students working with faculty, as well as early, mid, and senior career scholars. So it's really, again, a collaborative project that works both inside and outside of the institution in terms of me, who's unaffiliated, leading it, in support with Bruce Moran, who's the general editor of Ambix, as I mentioned. So in ways, it's like taking what I learned from Furnace and Fugue and seeing, taking this model of collaboration and seeing, you know, what this next iteration will produce in terms of models for the Academy.
Well, Donna, that sounds like a great project. Tara, would you like to add what you're working on currently?
Sure. So I am picking up two threads from one from Furnace and Fugue and one from my book, On Its Eaglerin and the Lion's Blood. So on the On Its Eaglerin project, I'm picking up the thread of what usually gets called love magic. And I'm interested in exploring the relationship between kind of history of emotions and material culture through thinking about gender and magic. I think of it more broadly as affective magic in the early modern period. So magic that can either win affections or alienate affections. So I'm beginning to explore that. And the other project that I'm thinking about has to do with, again, this kind of collaborative environment from Furnace and Fugue. A couple of years ago, I team taught a class with a professor at the Rhode Island School of Design, Rachel Berwick, who is a glass artist and professor in the glass department. And we team taught a class on kind of early modern making meaning in material culture. And it really got me thinking about the relationships between alchemy and glass in the early modern period as to what we might think of today as fields that practitioners often moved back and forth between. And so I'm sort of curious to see whether I can continue to collaborate with the glassmakers at RISD and incorporate some of that maybe into a scholarly project, jumping off from the history of alchemy into the history of glass. But we'll see. I'm very fortunate in that I'm taking a little bit of time right now to think carefully about what I want to do next rather than jumping right into the next thing. So we'll see what happens over the next couple of years.
Well, Tara Numedal and Donna Billock, those both sound like wonderful projects, and I look forward to hearing more about them and seeing them. I want to thank you both so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care to both.
Thank you so much, Molly. It was great to chat with you.
Thanks, Molly. This was a real pleasure.
Bye-bye.